All right, we have our last presentation. We have a different presenter than what was listed in the book. Today we're going to hear from Sherry Dworkin, who is the Associate Professor and Vice Chair at the UCSF Department of Social and Behavioral Sciences. Sherry has a research interest in gender relations and HIV prevention, with a specific focus on structural prevention programs. Today she's going to talk to us about assessing barriers and facilitators of implementing an integrated HIV prevention and property rights program in Western Kenya.
Thank you very much, and if we have more than 12 people in the audience in the last day, in the last session, we're doing beautifully, so congratulations to all the presenters. Thank you for sticking around. I have no personal financial relationships to disclose. I'm pleased to acknowledge the National Institute of Health and UCSF internal funders. What's really interesting to me, you can probably already gather since I was introduced as being interested in structural HIV prevention, is that we have lots of great information on drivers, poverty and gender inequality in particular identified as really important structural drivers of women's HIV risks. And yet when you look at the available structural interventions, a lot of the time when we zoom into the HIV prevention literature, programming tends to integrate economic empowerment and HIV prevention by focusing on microfinance. You've probably seen this in the intervention for microfinance and gender equity. You might have seen this in Zimbabwe, shaping the health of adolescents in Zimbabwe. What's been really interesting to me about these programs, I carried out a meta-analysis of numerous HIV prevention programs and other health programs that draw on microfinance and credit expansion in particular. And what's fascinating is that those programs don't really increase women's income very much. And we're hanging our hat on these slight improvements in income, which may not be enough to reshape gendered power in households. And it's frustrating to me because it's also the case that one of the most prominent findings within the microfinance literature when it comes to health programs is that women don't really control much of the extra income that's coming into the household. That's a very prominent finding. So I would argue that we need to move beyond simple income generation and think about access to ownership and control of harder assets such as land and property. And what does the literature tell us about land and property? Well, access to use and control over land and property really helps women to have a more secure means of livelihood than does a small amount of increased income alone. The literature shows us that this can enhance food security, improve gendered power in households, and we have some associational data in South Africa and elsewhere that show that property ownership can protect against domestic violence. But we know very little about the potential of property and land ownership to reducing HIV risk and mitigating HIV and AIDS impact in developing countries. As Janet Turan has already pointed out, since her work is also in Nyanza province, Kenya, it is the case that women are frequently blamed for HIV. And in this work that I'm carrying out, women are actually blamed for the death of their husband. And because they're vulnerable to property rights violations, what happens is when the husband dies, the woman is grieving. And typically during the funeral process, that's when the in-laws begin to facilitate a process of property grabbing and disinheritance. And in our own research and in the literature more broadly, we know that these vulnerabilities to property rights violations do exacerbate HIV risk because they diminish women's ability to bring in income and have livelihood strategies. This naturally disrupts women's source of shelter, their social support systems, and what we found in our own work is that this facilitates out-migration. Women generally take the children, take nothing, don't have any of their belongings, and migrate to beaches, slums, and markets where they're exchanging sex for food, goods, housing, or money. I am really interested in collaborating with partners who have highly innovative models on the ground that help to secure women's property rights and help to essentially connect her to HIV care and secondary HIV prevention. And what's interesting is that there are programs on the ground that carry out this kind of work, but the research base hasn't really caught up with these kinds of models. So in this pilot project, I was really interested in understanding the innovative strategies that one particular program deploys to help secure access to and ownership of land, to really look at the success of this program in securing women's property rights, look at the impact from the perspective of people who have been served by the program, post-program, to really see what they perceive in terms of health benefits. And in today's particular talk, I'll talk about just simply assessing the barriers and facilitators to implementing this kind of programming. And all of this is really being done with the goal, future goal in mind, to inform the designing and testing of future structural interventions at this intersection. So this is a collaboration between the University of California, San Francisco, the Kenyon Medical Research Institute, and a group called GROOTS Kenya. That stands for Grassroots Women Organizing Together in Sisterhood, and it's technically a network of community-based organizations that are either rights-based in their focus, health-oriented, leadership-oriented. And what they have designed at the local level is what's called a community land and property watchdog model. And you can tell from the name that the women are quite concerned about patterns of disinheritance and property rights violations, and they're trying to set up a local system to prevent property rights violations, monitor them, and to respond to them through mediation and paralegal aid and counseling. What's interesting is that if you pick up the constitution in Kenya and you take a look at it, women do have protection under the law, and furthermore, there's nothing stopping women from owning land, if you read the constitution carefully, and a new constitution has now been passed that kind of bolsters that right, and yet at the local level, a lot of times this isn't monitored or enforced. So what did we do? We actually have a larger study of 80 in-depth interviews where we talked to 30 people who negotiated property rights violations at the local level with families who are disinheriting, and they're trying to seek to resolve these cases and bring women back to their households. We talked to 30 people who were served, who were beneficiaries of this program. And in today's paper, I'm only going to zoom in on the small subsample of 20 program leaders who really designed and developed this program and are acutely aware of the barriers and facilitators to implementing this kind of programming. I'm working in Western and Nyanza province. As Janet Turan's already pointed out, Nyanza province has the highest HIV prevalence in the country. In the sub-districts where we're working, HIV prevalence is actually between 25 and 33%, and property rights violations are quite common. So we hired interviewers who were external to GROOTS Kenya and who were trained by our research team. The interviews were carried out in the local language, transcribed into the local language, and then transcribed into English. And we used a grounded theory approach, a lot of rigorous code book development, and used software programs and carried out inter-rater reliability on this kind of analysis to look at the most common barriers and facilitators to implementing this program. This is a picture not only of the research team, but also some of the members of the watchdog model. And I'm always embarrassed to see at how much better I was sleeping just a few months ago in this kind of picture than I have now, but moving right along. In terms of results, I'll just quickly cover four facilitators of implementing this intriguing integrated HIV-oriented and property rights program. First, buy-in and leadership from home-based health workers who are responding to the HIV epidemic in this very high seroprevalence environment. Second, we will only make brief mention of this today, but we're really doing an entirely separate analysis on the framing and the way in which grassroots women, paralegals, and players frame the need for this program and strategizing to appeal to multi-sectoral players who can help to resolve this problem on the ground. Third, the inclusion of traditional leaders, the Luo Council of Elders, as key mediators in these rights violations, and finally, the broader structural environment. So let's talk about these home-based caregivers. One very interesting thing is that women describe that as they're going door-to-door, helping to care for women who are HIV positive, they would come back one day and find that the women are missing. And in interview after interview, you see this epidemic of missing women, if you will. And this is how it is that home-based care workers came to understand, once they started talking to each other about people missing in their households, they came to understand that they had experienced property grabbing, disinheritance, eviction, and began to formulate the need for this program. So a big surge of interest at the grassroots level from home-based care workers. Second, the ability to link across the health sector, government sectors, local justice systems, and numerous other sectors like education and land and property. And one developer of the program says, we bring together all the stakeholders. We relate this specifically to HIV/AIDS. By the time we're addressing this, this is not an issue affecting just women, an issue just having to do with land. This is an issue affecting health. And they make explicit arguments about exacerbating the HIV epidemic locally and the difficulty that women have in experiencing continuity of care if they were connected to HIV care, given this process of migration and disinheritance, which is obviously extremely disruptive. Traditional leaders were collaborated with a great deal. They hold so much power on the ground in terms of determining what happens in specific cases when women are evicted and migrate to slums, market areas, and they're highly respected. This helps for this negotiation and mediation to be highly acceptable to community members. One woman tells us that someone came to the watchdog group, reported that she had been chased away from her household, and they say the first step we must take as a watchdog group is go to the village elder. They also have to do a lot of capacity building, obviously, because rights-based knowledge and the Constitution might not be on the tip of the tongue of the village elders, and hence there's a lot of rights-based capacity building that goes on in this group. More broadly, it's wonderful if you look at the Kenyan National HIV Strategic Plan. It's very specific in terms of how disinheritance and landlessness are identified as HIV risk factors. And this innovative model is so interesting because it's really looking at this problem from a multi-sectoral perspective, going to community health workers and training them as paralegals so that they can then mediate these cases on the local level and resolve the cases. Why is that important? Because for very poor women, it's extremely expensive to go to court, it's extremely time-consuming, rural women can't afford the costs, and furthermore, the cases take 2 to 10 years and rarely have a positive outcome for women. So this is a local means through which to secure access to and ownership of land during these violations. I'm running out of time, so I'll just talk about a couple barriers to implementing this innovative model. Of course, resource constraints, because it's a voluntary mechanism, and naturally this is the first time that such a group has collaborated with academic research partners, and we're interested in helping them to refine the model, bolster HIV prevention and care within it. And we have noticed, too, that there's, even though the 2010 Constitution recognized the informal justice mechanisms at the community level, there's a real lack of connection between the formal justice system and this more informal mechanism, and that needs to be bolstered quite a bit. So I'm going to just jump to conclusions because I only have a minute here. This incredibly innovative model was formulated without Western intervention or any intervention at all. And we're really the first academic partner to bring this model to light, to think carefully about how community health workers can really provide critical leadership as we take this work forward, to think about the importance of engaging traditional leaders, and to think about that intersection between health workers and HIV prevention and care. Naturally, the study has limitations. It's a small sample size. This was the full sample size of program leaders. We have limited generalizability, obviously, since we're doing this in two subsections of districts within these broader provinces. And in the future, we're really interested in bumping this up to a quantitative model where we can test the effect of this property rights programming on individual and community level HIV risk and violence outcomes. We came up with a lot of empowerment language in the qualitative data, and so we're interested in modifying and applying measures of empowerment so that we can see if, quote, empowerment-related processes are mediators through which property works to improve health, and hence we're interested, obviously, in testing property rights programming in the formal science space and thinking of this in the long run not only as an HIV prevention mechanism at the for primary or secondary prevention, but also to look at it for its potential as a treatment and care strategy as well. Thank you very much. Thank you.